Time for Ockham's Razor. Last week, Dr. Peter Underwood, professorial fellow at the University of Western Australia, told us about his trip to Korea and Japan on a peace mission, accompanied by his grandson. On the way, security confiscated Peter's beloved Swiss Army knife. So Professor Underwood plotted a kind of revenge involving the slight corruption of his grandson. This is how the story continues.
The MV Eastern Star was no cruise ship. It provided only one modest restaurant, a tiny shop selling a few staples and trinkets, and a small lounge and cafeteria serving bad coffee, drinks, and sandwich things. I sat my grandson down and said that I had something important to tell him. This is what I said. Dear son, I'm about to give you a proposition. Together we're about to have an adventure and make a quest. But first, I want to tell you a story. It's about my friend Frank. Frank's father, when aged 16, and for reasons never entirely clear, decided to run away from home. His home was Germany, just before the Second World War, with the Nazis in dreadful power. After many dangerous adventures, dependent only on his wits, the lone lad escaped. Eventually, he reached Australia and peace, married, and started his own family. One day, the father took aside his son, Frank, aged 7. He said, "Today, son, I'm going to teach you something important. You are going to learn how to fire a rifle. Believe me, I hope you will never need to use it in anger or in your defence. But the world is unpredictable. Bad things happen, and you need to know how to survive if need be." This was a lesson my friend never forgot. "And today, son, I'm going to teach you something. Not how to fire a rifle, but how to be a little more like Frank's brave father, escapee and survivor." My grandson looked enthralled but concerned. Well, he knew his grandfather's flights of fancy could be tricky. I continued, "What I propose is simple. You have to work out how we can get to the ship's restaurant, have a meal there, and not pay for it." "Why this?" "Well, because when a person undertakes a quest, they change and they learn things. Here there are two to learn. First, to observe, plan, and execute a stratagem, and in public. Second, and related, to get to know the gorgeous trickery of words." He said he wasn't promising anything, but he'd hear me out. A little later, I explained the scenario. The ship's passengers occupied only 3 decks, and the sole restaurant was situated on the middle deck near the bow of the ship. Closed except at meal times, it was reached via an open companionway running down one side of the ship. The entrance to this companionway was on the 3rd or lower deck towards the stern of the ship, and the narrow passage then ran forwards, open to the sea, to end with a short set of stairs running up to the restaurant entrance on the deck above. All was designed to regulate admission. Passengers purchased a meal voucher from the office, then took the ticket down to the lower deck, where they handed it in to an attendant guarding the entrance, then entered the companionway leading to the restaurant, walked down it, and climbed the stairs to enter the restaurant. It appeared that the restaurant could be reached only via the companionway and its one guarded entrance. "What now?" he asked. "First," I replied, "you need to study the setup. I want a complete picture of how things work. Second, make a plan for us. Somehow, we've got to get to the tables without a ticket, without detection. And I don't want one. Give me 2 or 3 plans and we'll choose the best." He said he'd think about it. A little later, he said he'd decided. He didn't want to do it. It was dishonest. But he would help devise the plan, and I could do it alone if I wanted to. I concurred. But added a softener. I agreed, eventually, to pay for the meal and whether we'd been busted or were triumphant. The next hours were intense. Every facet of the processing of diners was scrutinised. In the end, both plans my grandson came up with, Plan A to forge a meal ticket and Plan B to enter the companionway by distracting the custodian of the entrance, were abandoned as too risky. It was back to the drawing board. Minutes later, he returned full of excitement. He'd found an additional secret way into the companionway. There was a fairly well-hidden space adjoining the companionway between the guarded entrance and the stairs leading up to the restaurant, and it connected through to the companionway on the other side of the ship. And this one was unguarded. Though the space was roped off and crammed with stuff like life rafts and funnels, it seemed that if we were agile and watchful, we could enter the space from the opposite side of the ship and conceal ourselves amongst the gear. Then, picking our time and jumping or sliding under the rope barricade, we could enter the companionway and stroll into the restaurant. There were dangers. First, from time to time, an attendant from the restaurant came out and stood at the top of the stairs to check the queue. Second, if there were those in the queue who saw us jump into it, they might dob us in. But we reckoned, on balance, if vigilant enough, we were in with a chance. Thus, at the time of the next meal, there we were, the two of us squeezed in a crowded space amidships, from time to time surreptitiously darting out to check the lie of the land, one eye to the top of the stairs, the other to any break in the line of potential diners making their way along the companionway. Then, one of us throwing our preordained signal of thumbs up, we were slithering into the companionway, and a few seconds later, breathless, trying not to laugh, standing in a line of passengers holding our empty plates before the steaming buffet. And we it was. Despite his misgivings, my grandson had found the challenge of our escape irresistible. In the climax, in the funnels, he dropped me the signal and then, to my delight, threw caution aside. Gracefully leaping the rope into the passageway before me, with well-rehearsed calm, it was he who had led us down the narrow passageway towards our little grail. Less than an hour later, our stomachs full, we returned to the cafeteria to chew it over. Yes, we appeared victorious, but I couldn't help but first warning that it's not over till the fat lady sings. Precisely then, a crew member approached us at our table. "Are you Mr. Underwood?" she asked. My heart fell. "Well, yes," I said. "You are wanted at once at the purser's office," she left. We got up. "Remember," I said, "our agreement. If sprung, we plead ignorance and confidently. And pay up, with alacrity looking sorry." We trudged to the purser's office and presented ourselves. The woman serving had a face resembling those little pastry people my mother and I used to make, with currants for eyes and a piece of orange rind for a mouth. The currants stared and the rind opened a little. "Mr. Underwood," she said, "your passport, please give." I handed it over. She checked the number on the inside page. Looking up, she said, "Here, returning, is your pocket knife." That was all she said. She handed it over, wrapped in the same brown piece of paper with my name and passport number inscribed. I put it in my trouser pocket. We turned away. Quietly, we began laughing. "It seems the fat lady has sung," I whispered. And so she had. It was a spring day back in Australia's rural southwest, a little after we'd returned. Birds were calling to each other and mother ewes to their lambs. I took my grandson aside. "I've just written a letter," I said, and began reading. "To the Managing Director, Eastern Ferries and Shipping, Dong Hai, South Korea. Dear Sir or Madam, this is to inform you that my grandson and I have just completed a trip between Vladivostok and Japan on your vessel, the Eastern Star. While improvements could be made to arrangements for disembarkation in Korea, we found that your services were largely satisfactory. However, I wish to bring one matter to your attention. One occasion, while partaking of a modestly sustaining dinner, we realised that, somehow or other, we'd reached the restaurant without purchasing a meal ticket and, in the event, didn't end up paying for the meal. It may be that you yourself are a parent or, like myself, a grandparent. Therefore, you know how crucial it is for us to educate and serve as models to our offspring. Therefore, aware as I am of the debt I owe your company, I here attach an Australian $20 note. This, with a small margin favourable to you, covers the cost of the meal. Naturally, I will inform my grandson of what is, I hope, an equitable, indeed I believe, a moral resolution of this matter. Yours sincerely." Addressing him, I said, "If you look at this letter, you will see that every word is true. Yet it doesn't tell the whole truth. Indeed, its truth conceals the truth. So, as promised, our escapade at sea has set you off on another lovely quest. To seek out words, for they bind us all together with soft rootlets. Or, better still, are a part of us, our offspring really, in their beauty or in their sometimes sweet sense of deceit." I took him up and hugged him, and in unison the wind sighed, a bird sang, and a ewe greeted her lamb. And joyful, together, the silver head and the boy began to laugh, along with all the natural things, wordlessly.
Professor Peter Underwood at the University of Western Australia with that shaggy Occam's razor. Next week, Peter Ward in Adelaide on science funding.